July 13th in Skiatook with Bob Maris.
Case on.
Okay, Bob, the first thing that I'm interested in your saying something about is just the what it was like to be at KSAM in terms of the weather, the hills, all the things about the feel of the place.
Yes. As you know from seeing the pictures, the fog, I think, is probably one of the most impressive things that I saw, or that I can really remember. And you leaf through photographs, and you're always seeing a picture with fog and how dense it is. And then you add to that the steepness of like 861. That was the first hill that we went up. We went up in daylight, and we passed bodies along the way. Both theirs and as well as ours. And then at the first night on 861, this fog started rolling in. And this is our first day at Quezon. And so this is our first experience with the fog. And then coupled with the fear, or the anxiety, or the anticipation of what's going on behind the fog, and then being on a listening post, which is a two-man position, you and a buddy that are out there, trying to hear through the fog, and then again coupled with the sounds of the jungle, because Quezon, 881, 861, north and south, was all really thick jungle when we started out. And I don't think that to this day you could call 881 881 because it's been reduced to 850 in elevation. And just very thick jungle, trees, fog. They had a lot of razor grass up there too, I remember, because you were getting cut on it going up. And I think I saw my very first live uncaged parrot. It was at Quezon, and that always impressed me. In the this was while we were taking 881, and we were carrying a wounded Marine back down the hill, and we had to stop for a while, and everybody catch their breath. And Coleman was working on the old boy, and I remember that I looked off to my left and saw a live parrot and, flying around in battle. I mean, this guy just didn't even know that people were dying out there. Flowers and things like that. It's Quezon itself. When we first got there, it was it was beautiful. It was just virtually untouched, other than some of the airstrikes they started while we were there. And what we first saw was just a big mountainous tropical garden, like you see in the movies and things like Shangri-La, virtually like that. But then, when we applied our assignment or our mission to it, it just, it started to become, a little bit uglier. And then by the time we got off of it, I really didn't care to see that place ever again. And, it's just really amazing how something can start out so beautiful like that and just turn it into a nightmare. It was uphill, all the way. Even going down, it seemed like it was uphill when you were out there marching, carrying stuff. But I would say that the most impressive thing to me was that fog and its thickness. And it was an asset to you, and it could also be a liability to you in that, you're just as well hit as he is. And it's at that point that, your instincts and his instincts, and that everybody is equal right there. You're all equalized. The air support's not going to help you. Nothing's going to help you except what you know, what you learned, and that what he knows and what he's learned, and in the terrain that he was brought up in, and that's his country and his turf. And it kind of worries you a little bit,
Bob. The next thing, in terms of terrain, What did the artillery do to the hilltops?
As we moved to, we would just move from hill to hill on a captured by basis or something like that. Just like 861, it seemed like we weren't stalled there at all. I mean, we took 861 relatively quick, and it's, you know, your mind just wanders on. You don't really think as a machine gunner. I don't about anything, you know, about the overall, the big picture of capturing and securing. You worry day to day about am I going to survive for tonight or something tomorrow? And as we moved into an area, you would notice that artillery had been there, airstrikes had been there. I mean, you could look and just tell, you know, well, that small crater was made by a 155 or 105 round, and this large crater right here obliterated two or three small craters. And I'm sure that artillery had a lot of effect on the hill, but as far as changing its appearance, the large blockbuster bombs that they were dropping from the air support, just, you know, it just disfigured the hill, like, you know, the jungle that I was telling you about. I remember looking at there between 81 north and south, there is a saddle, and this saddle was just, you know, almost laid bare. It just looked like a brush hog had been through and tore a place down, just a tangled mess. And you would see a lot of jungle, dense jungle, and then you'd see the equivalent of where that brush hog had been, only there would be a crater there. And that's what that blockbuster would do. And they were trying to get at the enemy that were down in the bunkers that made of green bamboo. And that green bamboo is just as strong and sturdy as supported steel. And even after, you know, all of our airstrikes and everything, that was our primary mission. We was called up there to clean them out. And there were still a lot of folks untouched, maybe rattled a little bit from the noise, but they were down in there with all their equipment and everything, and they were ready to do battle when we got there to them. And they did do battle.
Could you tell me about these enemy bunkers? I don't remember actually ever reading about them.
I can't imagine anybody not hearing about them. You know, to us, you know, we would hear about news stories, and they would say, you know, the Battle of Quezon, it was a raging aerial fight and everything else like that. Well, us on the ground, to us, it was, you know, it was a grenade battle. Them throwing grenades at us, and us throwing them right back at them. Us seeing the enemy, them seeing us. Everybody getting shot from the head and shoulders area, because those damn bunkers, they had snipers in them with scopes and the rifles and things like that. They'd come up and pick you off. You'd always have a head and shoulders wound. And that's when they wanted to finish you off quick. They could wound a guy. They'd get another Marine to come over and aid him, you know, medically, or a corpsman or something like that. They'd finish off the corpsman or his buddy. Then they'd finish this old boy off. And that was their SOP. Wound one, and it takes three or four guys to get him out. And, you know, it's just like a turkey shoot there. And I know that when we went up the saddle to capture 881, it was just, you see in a movie, you really don't believe it in training, but this is the way that the Marine Corps does it. And it was effective. It worked. And we laid down a base of fire on one hill. And you look across, and you could see these bunkers. You can see the bunkers. You can see the openings. And you just can't see into them. You can't see the folks, even if aided. But you know that they're there. And this is on the side of a hill. And for some reason, this is etched in my mind, because we lost a lot of people, and I got to see it just like it was a movie. When we laid down a base of fire, and the assaulting element had formed up just below us, and then we were told to cease fire, we had virtually nothing to do but watch what was going to go on during the assault. And while they were sweeping through, then we were to move. But as they started the assaulting force, on line, on foot, walking up this this hill and into these bunkers and things like that, you would see guys drop, and you know, there is a difference between a man jumping for cover and a man just dropping. You know, I mean, his whole body weight's gone. And I can recall seeing maybe two or three guys jumping for cover. But near the two or three guys that were jumping for cover, you'd see a man drop. And you'd know right away, you know, I mean, there's another one that's been shot. And I saw one Marine that was shot through the neck, and he was drug into a bunker. And he had a .45 on him at the time. And we had moved up at this time on the hill itself. And this was the day that we captured Kason. And we moved up onto the hill, and this was happening off to my left, and I wasn't a part of it when it first occurred. But then it seemed like for some reason everything stopped, and the whole focal point of the war was this one bunker that had this Marine in it. And our officer, I think a first lieutenant or a staff sergeant, one of the two, or both of them, were interpreters. And they came up and they were talking to the people in the hole. And one of the Marines that was this guy's buddy reported that as soon as he was drug into the hole, they heard a shot. And they said, you know, we think he's dead. We think the Marine's dead, because we called to him, told him, groan or moan or something, so that we know you're alive, so we won't take an action, you know. And our interpreters were talking to the Vietnamese in there, trying to find out how many were in there, if they were alive and everything else like that. And finally, there was some indication made that there was one in there. And the staff sergeant told another Marine to pull the pin on the grenade and toss it to him. Pull the pin and then toss it to him. And he was standing on the bunker. And this old boy pulled the pin on the grenade, let the spoon fly, tossed it to him. He caught it, put it down in the hole, and just, you know, just like he was going on a stroll, he just casually stepped off the top of the bunker. And you could hear the thud inside of the explosion. He stepped back onto it, and he says, toss me another one. You know, and at this time, some guys were questioning, what the guy was doing. He says, toss me another one. The old boy does the same thing again. Pulls a pin, lets a spoon fly, tossed him the other one. And he tossed it in there. And he stepped off of it again, and it exploded. And what had happened, you know, by instinct, by luck, or whatever, this old boy that threw the grenades down in there, the first grenade that he threw, no one knew how many Vietnamese were down in there, and we just really gut reaction that the Marine was killed, because the guys had yelled to him, and they were sure that he would have made an obvious sound. And they heard the one shot. The first grenade that was thrown in, there were two Vietnamese machine gunners in there. The first one sat on the grenade and smothered it, saving the life of the other Vietnamese. Had anybody looked down in that bunker, their machine gun, which was operative, would have surely killed him. The second grenade, in the manner that this old boy was throwing the grenades down in there, and out of a 7-second delay, he was already using up five of them, just getting the thing down in there. Because he was still standing on the bunker when the second grenade went off. He didn't have time to clear the bunker. And it killed both of them. The Marine, whose body that we found down in there, in addition to being shot in the throat, he was shot in the head. And that's the only bullet wounds that he had on him. So that second shot was the shot that was in his head that killed him. And he received, I think, two or three shrapnel wounds that were in his legs. So it wouldn't have, you know, it wouldn't have hurt him. And he was already laying, you know, in the hole. But let
me just stop for a moment. This is going very well. I hope this is not wearing you out or boring you. Okay. Yeah, do you see any hilltop scenes that you might want to pick out? Like, I could even put down the page number.
Some of these don't have any pages to them.
Well, that's 158, 60, 61.
Yep. This is the vegetation that I was talking about. You know, even at its clearest point, it's thick. you know, moving through this stuff. And, you know, I remember a couple of times, you know, I think I was 19 years old. I just turned 19 at that time. And, you know, God, 19 years old, I'm in prime shape, you know. And I'm seeing a bunch of these old hosses around me that are normally, they're the big guys. You know, I look up to these guys because they're so strong and everything. And on the way up to 861, it beat us all, I swear. It was just, you know, here we are moving to war, just wearing ourselves to a frazzle, just trying to make, you know, headway. But you've got to go up there because we were looking for Marines that had been shot up. And I saw guys fall out on the wayside. Just, you know, they were saying, "Hey, I can't go." And you can't believe it. And the guys were, you know, seemed to be defeated like that. The mountains, moving in those things, it was really tough. It was really a hard way to go. You know, the rest of the war, it didn't seem like it was that bad. You know, moving. But the highlands, just, you know, trying to get through all that jungle and stuff like that, uphill through the jungle. It was difficult.
Any other hilltop scenes that, like, this is a medevac. Can you, anything about medevac that you might want to say? That's 62, 63.
Yeah, there's one coming in here. Having been a user of medevac several times while I was there, I don't know. Every time that we would see a chopper, it would make, and I'm not the only one that would react to it or anything else like that. Whenever you would see a chopper, it's like being rescued. You know, it's like being stranded out on a desert island, and every time you see something like that, you know, that's your contact with civilization, because you know that those aircraft are going to go back to where there's a lot of people, you know, not necessarily the enemy either. And, you know, stuck at Quezon, that was our food supply and ammo supply. And they were extremely important at that time, not necessarily in that order. There was times that I'd rather have bullets than beans. And we went through an awful lot of grenades and stuff, and that was our only way of getting them in and out. Were helicopters. And what was really most important was the medevacs. I saw pilots do things that just, you know, it would scare us to look at them. And, I wonder, you know, why is he doing that? You know, shouldn't there be some other way, you know, of getting that bird down to get this old boy back? And they would go to phenomenal feats to bring out, you know, the dead. And that right there just made, you know, an old boy could relax at that point, saying, you know, if something happens, I'm not going to be left here. And that was the good thing. And that's something that the Marine Corps, I guess, is always, you know, pumped into you from the word go. But, you know, you actually get to see it. They talk about it. They talk about the online assaults and everything, you know, and the John Wayne approach to doing things. I've seen it done. And I've seen it work. It worked at Quezon. And never leave your dead. Never leave a buddy. They talk about it. It's in movies, and everybody, you know, says, "Well, that's what's gung-ho about the Marine Corps." Well, it is, but it works, and it's effective.
And could you describe just your own personal medevac, just what happened and
which time?
At Quezon,
I wasn't medevac. Okay. I stayed. We were losing a lot of folks, and it was a piece of shrapnel, and it went through my elbow right here, and it just came out through here, and just it tore some. No, it went in here, and came out here. I was laying in a crater, which was there were a lot of them around, and that was a real good place to hide. You know, it just looked like a ready-made bomb shelter, and we were all down inside of a crater, and a piece of shrapnel from some artillery came through my elbow here and came out here, and it landed right in the I've still got the chunk around the house someplace, but it landed right in the web of my pack, and it just cauterized everything, and it didn't do anything. They patched it all up and cleaned it all out and everything else like that, and I stayed.
Could you just describe what it was to be someone who was medevaced?
You know, at first, when you see the chopper, you know, you'll see always more than one chopper, because the dust offs have security that flies with them. You know, they'll have a gunship or something like that. And I was medevaced by both the old CH-34, the old little thing from Korea, and the CH-47, the twin-bladed job. And when you look up and you see that chopper, you're wondering, is that one for me? Is this going to be mine to get me out of here? And you know, of course, you're hurting a little bit and everything, and you just wonder, you know, if that's yours. The first thing. And then finally, when it comes in and it sets down, and you've got some people there helping you, and they pick up you, all your equipment, and you've got that tag, it's flapping in the breeze, and it's flapping in your face and everything. And, you know, in my instance, one of the most dramatic medevacs of myself that I can remember was when I was shot through the leg there. And I had a piece of adductor muscle in my hand, because I thought, you know, I was stupid and I was in shock, I'm sure. And I thought they would put it back together, you know, put it back in there. And wrong, you know, chuck it over the side of the ship. And, you know, I staggered on this old this aircraft, and you know, this is your buddies helping you aboard this thing. And, you know, you're so glad to see it and everything. And then when that hatchway comes up and you're taking off, you know, and they shoot you straight up to get out of, you know, away from the rounds and things. Then you have, you know, you have a feeling of insecurity or loneliness, because those are the guys that you're living with, and they're helping you stay alive. They just helped you, you know, to get treated and everything else like that. And just, you know, you miss them right away, and from then on everything's going to be new to you. You get wheeled into a squad bay on a hangar deck, and you know, there's a bunch of people fussing around you, and the first thing they do is they pick up your tag, and you're just, you know, you're kind of like a hunk of beef, and everybody's examining you for a while. You know, there's nothing personal going on, and they look at your tag. If you're real bad, then you become very personal to them. You become a real immediate, responsive item there. If it's something that's more or less minor, like apparently my gunshot was, you know, not as serious as some other guys' wounds, and you know, my response was, you know, I'm just being examined for the time being. And then when they start to work on you, it's, you know, it's just you, you know, and
okay, well, this might be a time to go to this photograph. This is when you get your leg wound, right?
Yes, I got shot.
Okay. Could you say something about the photographs? Here at some later time, we might want to record them, you know, tape them and so on. Yeah, about what happened. What was the incident itself? And just briefly, you don't have to.
Well, these wounds here, those and these, this incident here. My closest buddy and I were celebrating our tenure in the Marine Corps, and we were in a foxhole, and just out in front of our foxhole we had a Claymore mine set up as a defensive mechanism. And so that morning we were going to go out and roll up the wire, check the Claymore, and pull it down and get ready to move out. And as we were doing this, Tony had an M16 and I had a 45. Or my buddy had a M16 and I had a 45. And we were walking out about 40 meters in front of our perimeter. And really thick vegetation. And as we walked down towards the where the Claymore itself was, Tony heard a shot and I felt it. And this old boy was down inside a spider trap. And I had just passed by him and was really behind him when he shot. And shot me in the back of the leg, and it, you know, I had on some, I'll never forget the feeling of having this happen, is I had on some brand new jungle utilities, a very hard commodity to come by. And when I got shot, it just, you know, the left inner thigh just exploded, and it looked like a big old chunk of hamburger flying out in front of me. And I remember seeing that cloth, and I thought, gee, man, boy, those new pants are gone. And it never dawned on me that I was shot from behind, because as soon as I got shot, some people that were out in front of me, they opened up on us. And this was my first indication that, hey, there's people out in front of you. You've already been shot, and they're the ones that are shooting at you. And when as soon as I got shot, my left leg just went out like I was kicking, and I lost my balance. And when I fell down, I started crawling immediately. Tony started crawling immediately, and we were yelling back and forth to keep contact with each other, not to, you know, start shooting on one another. And I crawled to a little knoll, which happened to be the same knoll that the old boy was at the base of, that shot me. So I'm up here, he's down here, and Tony is right out in here behind a little dike. And we're taking fire from right here, and as of yet, this old boy hasn't fired yet a second time. So as I got around on the back side of this hill to provide more cover for myself, and I looked down and I could see Tony at an angle like this, and I started shooting out front, and I've only got a 45, see, so I'm doing some good, I don't know, but I threw out some rounds. And I heard another shot real close to me, and I knew that it wasn't Tony's weapon. And it was this old boy down in the hole had shot Tony across the arm, which is, you know, that happens to be a real funny thing, because Tony had this tattoo of this gal that he once went with, but it wasn't the gal that he was going with at the present time that he wanted to get married to her and everything. And he was saying, boy, I just wish I could get rid of this tattoo, wish I could get rid of this tattoo. And so help me God, that bullet, the only damage that it did, it did some muscle damage inside his forearm a little bit, but it erased that tattoo completely. And he had an eye or something, Lori or something was this gal's name, and he had part of the dotted eye on there. And when Tony was on the hospital ship, he asked the doctor, he says, is there any way while you're, you know, sewing this up that you could cut out that, the rest of that, and sew it back together? And the old boy says, yeah, sure. So he got rid of that tattoo, and that, you know, solved one of his problems. But when this guy had shot Tony, he exposed himself to me with his back, or three quarters to me. And I saw him coming up out of the spider trap, and then, you know, it just looked like the ground was coming up, and a mole was coming out of it with a gun. And, you know, I knew that Tony was shot then. And as this old boy started to bolt home another round, I shot him behind the right ear. Just, you know, it just seemed like a contact wound, because, I was really close to him when I reached out, because I remember extending out just as close as I could to him. I wanted to grab him if I could, and I reached out and shot him, and he, you know, he fell just like everybody else did. And a couple of buddies came back, and they threw two frag grenades down in the hole. Consequently, you see this, and it's like that. And I was a machine gunner, and you asked about, you know, what does a machine gun do? That's a machine gun. This right here, you know, it blew this old boy's right arm off, literally. Just the impact of that, and it's, you know, And it, you know, at Quezon, it was really weird because we would see, we found people that were wired, the Vietnamese, that had wire wrapped all around their arms and things. And, you know, I don't know if you'd ever heard of it. I'd never seen it before. I thought, you know, I said, why these people got, you know, why do they have wire wrapped around their arms and their legs and their extremities, things like that? And it's so that, you know, the psychological effect of this, when you'd shoot an old boy, you wouldn't blow his arm off. You know, shoot a guy right in here and he loses his arm from, say, the elbow down. Well, they were all wrapped up and taped up and everything else like that, and it would still, they would still be intact. And, you know, the people that were fighting next to him, although a guy could have a severe blast, it completely disintegrated everything in the impact area. He would still be together, and therefore, you know, their religion is, if you're, you know, if you're decapitated in any way or something like that, you don't get to see Buddha. And so, you know, that would frighten them, you know, and demoralize the enemy soldier, I would imagine, religiously as well as, you know, just physically and psychologically seeing it and saying, you know, oh my God, Ho Chi just got his arm and leg blown off. And he's not going to Buddha, and maybe the same thing happened to me. Maybe I better quit fighting.
Let me, okay, I guess we've covered these. This is going fine. I'm awfully pleased with it. You mentioned in the Duncan book at page 55, in terms of wounded people.
Oh, Huckabee.
He's on page 55. You recognized him even though he's not.
Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it. Huckabee, this guy, by the way, here's a bunch of Marines. Huckabee, by the way, this guy has got to have, at the time that this picture's taken, he's got to have about 5 Purple Hearts. Because I knew that he had, like, 3 or something, you know, at the time. There was some kind of a mix-up and thing, you know, that... He got him before he could get medevaced out. You know, different days. He was in a situation where they had to have him.
Sure what was he? What was his job, or do you know anything about what happened?
Huckabee was a machine gunner. He was, I believe, he was in Weapons Platoon, Gulf Company, but he was in a different squad than mine was in, that I was in. And you know, a real quiet guy. You know, he had a distinctive face. Here's another. It's Bell right there. He's a radio operator. This is old Huckabee. He just looked like a rugged individual. You know, a Western type guy. Where he was from, I really can't remember. So we'll hear.
How was he wounded, you know?
I think he took some shrapnel to the stomach. You can see the pads and things that they've got over here. This is not his stomach. He was a real fit, sturdy old boy, and this is dressing, I'm positive. But this right here, I recognize this as being ICU, because they when I went to the triplet.
What do you mean by ICU? Why don't you explain that?
Intensive care.
Where would
unit.
This be?
This is on the USS Tripoli. I remember I was being transferred from the Princeton, which was our support ship for our assault group. We were being transferred from the Princeton, which is a World War II converted carrier, to the Tripoli, brand new air conditioned, new facility and everything. It had a 5-degree built-in list in it. And there was a Vietnamese major that was caught in an artillery attack. And this guy lost his butt, literally. He was laying flat on the ground, and a piece of shrapnel came by and cleaned out both of his cheeks. And just ripped all the meat out of him, and they put the flaps back, and he was laying on his stomach, and he was right across from me on a stretcher on this chopper, and I'm looking at him, and and smiling and just trying to communicate, because, you know, at that time, I asked who it was, found out who it was, and that it was a South Vietnamese major. And he's one of the good guys, and at least he's another wounded human being that's suffering. And when I found out what had happened to him, I thought, God, boy, that must be painful. But whenever that major had to use the bathroom, it was a general operation just about. And I thought, but he was in there with me. And that major was in ICU. And Huckabee came in shortly after I left. I was able to walk, and I got out of there. I started walking around. They got tired of seeing me. I'd walk up to the operations on the war, and the war room there in the ship, and guys would say, "Yeah, hey, come on in." I'd wear my blue hospital gown and my crutches, and trying to get my leg back in shape. The old doctor said, "That's the best thing for it, is get around, and move it and stuff."
Let me ask you a question about a humorous situation. What's the funniest thing that happened to you out there in the boonies? It doesn't have to be at Quezon necessarily. But one of the things we want to do is show the funny side of life. Or you've already indicated some of the humor,
Tony's tattoo.
With the tattoo and so on. That's very funny in a way, but it's also kind of perilous, too. I'm sorry. One thing I want to... We're still on the wounded. You have a picture here of
Jaggers?
Yeah, and I think this would be the appropriate time before we go on to other things to talk about that.
That's a bad one there. This guy only had like 40 days in country, this the only picture that I ever took of another dead Marine, was this one, and the only reason I did it was because he's in the bag and you can't see him or nothing like that. But I just wanted it to remind me of him. And the only thing that I can really remember him by is Jag. That was his nickname, and he was from Mississippi, and he spoke with the accent and everything that you had. And I didn't really get to know him up until the time that he, just a few days before he was killed, we were fixing to start the operation at Quezon. He was a short timer. He was given the option of staying on board ship in supply because he had so much time left in country, or to go out in the field. And he wanted to go out in the field with these friends. And we had just gotten a resupply of food, and Jaggers had been transferred, out of a line company into supply, kind of the rear with the gear. And he took charge of all of the food from the helicopter. He filled his hole with cases of sea rations. And I remember we were all sitting around his hole on the side of, this is 881, after we had, this 881 south, I believe. We hadn't completed capturing all the hills yet. And while we were sitting there talking, and he was giving us our individual food, some artillery rounds started falling in. And they were our own rounds, and some of them landed short, and Jaggers was killed, another guy lost his leg, I think Tony was wounded. Tony wasn't with me at the time, he was back at our hooch, and I dove into, I made a guest appearance at somebody else's hole, and had I been at our hooch, probably I'd have been wounded along with Tony. And Jaggers tried to get into his hole, but his hole was filled up with all these cases. He'd put them down in his hole. And so he laid on top of them as best as he could, and it just, he was decapitated. And just before this happened, what we were talking about, I can remember seeing it. Tony got up to say, I'm going home, and he gets up and walks over to his little hole. And we had just lost a bunch of people, and that had been one terrible day. Golden had gotten shot in the hip. Corporal Dye was, and that's another thing, I a Corporal Dye. I thought, you know, that's a hell of a name to be, you know, Dye, having in a place like this. And he was killed. He died. The other guy that we were dragging down the mountain, when I saw the parrot and stuff like that, I never did look down into the poncho to see him, because he had a big battle dressing over his face. And Tony was there with me. Our squad was, we were one of the advancing elements into this thing. And we were carrying him down, and everybody was saying, you know, oh God, it's so hot, you know, and sweaty and steamy. The jungle was just dripping because of the humidity. And then it started to rain. During the battle, it started to rain. And it cooled things off, and it just drenched you, and the sound of those, you remember how it was, the sound of those damn raindrops hitting on that helmet, it sounds like a machine gun going off in your head. And while we were carrying this guy in a poncho, his battle dressing fell down. And, you know, that's the first time that we'd seen what had happened to this guy. And he didn't have a face. It was just, you know, it was all gone. He had a lower jaw, and from about middle upper lip to eyebrow, it was all, he had taken one of those headshots sideways. His eyeballs, it was just really ugly. His eyeball was out and everything else. And, I remember that all of us just, we weren't really shocked, amazed, or anything else like that. You know, we'd seen people killed, you know, and terribly torn apart and stuff, but, you know, like, no one cared, and no one's going to be ashamed that the other guy's thinking out loud or saying something out loud. And I remember that we all just, you know, prayed to God to let this guy die. And I remember hearing Tony say it too. You know, he says, God, he says, let him die. And we carried this old boy back, you know, to try and keep him alive and everything else like that. But he had died while he was en route. The helicopter was right there in the heat of the battle, and we loaded him up in that sucker. And that's the time that I was telling you about. That, you know, we knew that this guy was going to die. It was obvious to everybody that was there. And you know, here were these old pilots down there just still trying to get him out. And we had gone through this type of thing that day. And while we were sitting around the hole, old Jaggers says, Tony says, let's go, you know, let's go on back up there, kick their ass, you know. He says, you know, because everybody had lost a lot of good friends. The corpsman that worked on me that day, he was wrapping my arm up, and they started calling for him. He says, Maris, he says, can you take it from here, buddy? He says, I've done all that I can do, and you're going to be all right. I said, yeah, sure, go ahead and go. And he went on up, and he was killed. You know, I mean, just like that. And, you know, it just seemed strange. You'd be talking to an old boy, and he's, you know, on a very personal basis, trying to help you, really, you know, trying to render you some aid, and then the next minute he's no longer there. And Jaggers was saying, you know, Tony was wanting to go up and get right back into the heat of battle and kill them all and everything, and he was just really upset because we'd lost all these guys. Jaggers says, hey, he says, you know, he says, if all I had to do was go from this hill to that hill, shoot him up a little bit, come back and know that I'd be alive. Because he says, I'm getting short, guys. And he says, I want to open up a grocery store in Mississippi. You know, and no one will mess with me. It's just a grocery store. You know, that's it. And this was this guy's goal in life. And he knew that within, you know, 30 or 40 days, that's what he was going to do. 2 minutes later, 3 minutes later, he was dead. And when he was killed, so was his dream and everything. And he was a young guy. He could have done it. He would have done it. And all he had to do is just, you know, put very little effort forth, and he could have done, you know, something simple like that, I'm sure. But
this is
hell of a guy.
This is real, you know, very important to us. This is the sort of thing that personalizes a lot of these. Okay, what about the humor? What's a, you know, to get off the, you know, something else. What's the funniest thing that ever happened to you out in the field? As I say, it doesn't have to be at Quezon.
Sure, there is. There,
you never get run down by a water buffalo, or a regular buffalo, did you?
No, we got checked.